Hoda rushed and went to get into bed, where she was quite astonished to see the way her grandmother was living.
Discover the secrets of the fairies every Wednesday morning from 9 to 10 on WPRK 91.5, the voice of Rollins College and the best of basement radio.
What big arms you have, grandmother!
The better to hug you with, my child.
What big ears you have, grandmother!
The better to hear you with, my child.
What big teeth you have, grandmother!
The better to eat you with. Upon saying these words, the Wicked Wolf pounced on Little Red Riding Hood and ate her up.
The views and opinions expressed in the following program do not necessarily reflect those of WPRK, its management, or employees of Rollins College.
7 years, I think. You know, they told me to ask for a loan, a small loan. They told me that I was not economically viable. And yeah, I think it was 7 years. Excuse me, sir. How'd your loan work out? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like. Economically viable. No.
All right, good morning, Winter Park, and you have tuned in to Punkonomics here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. The voice of Rollins College, the best in basement radio. And moving right along, our resident host, Dr. Benny Balick. Say hello, Benny.
Yeah, hello. Good morning.
And our guest, Corey Carroll.
Good morning, guys.
All right, so what's the topics for today?
I don't know. I kind of just posted it. I'm a little bit in vapors, like I just posted on the blog, which I encourage people actually to follow if you really want to get all the link-ups, because as I was sharing with Corey right now, many people don't realize, anybody who has a page on Facebook has probably noticed that there's this button next to every time you post something that says promote. Now, you know, we're small-time fish on Facebook, definitely. I think, well, we have like 218 last I checked, I think, followers. So definitely not, we're building audience other places like Tumblr and Twitter. So certainly Twitter's fast-growing.
I need to get on Twitter. I still don't even use Twitter.
It's an interesting tool, actually, Twitter. It's so simple and open and it doesn't lend itself. You can actually program it to do different things. You have funny things, like, you know, whenever you tweet the word communism or socialism, as sometimes we have tweeted when it was appropriate for the show, there's Bot McCarthy? There's the Senator McCarthy from the era of McCarthyism phase, you know, there's a Twitter account that's automatic, and you can do that with Twitter. Okay. So when he just trolls all the Twitter scape or whatever it would be called, and retweets you. So it's kind of funny. I mean, you know, you can whenever, if you tweet the word socialism or communism, you're going to get retweeted to many, many tens of thousands. I don't, because the problem is that you get so many of them that it just swamps your feed. So it gets, after you get the joke, it gets annoying. But that shows that you can actually legally, kind of legal hack, basically. So if you can take control of your account. And that's precisely why I'm so concerned with Facebook, which with all its commercial woes, despite being the biggest network on planet Earth ever, and scarily so, with well over a billion users, when you have a page, like our Punkonomics page, People have pages for many different reasons, right? A page, not a group. And people like you, right? And you expect that when you post to that page, right, everybody who likes you gets that post. As every of us on Facebook probably like different things, right? And therefore we get those posts and we think we're getting them all. But no. Once you go over, I mean, above, apparently it's really above 1,000 the problem starts, but I wonder, frankly, if it's not lower. Only a subset of your fans will get your post. You want more people to get your post?
That explains a lot, actually.
Give us, yeah. Give us some money. If you ever click on that promote button, you'll see that, oh, you want to get reach 1,000 to 2,000 fans? $5. You want, you know, 2,000 to 5,000? $10.
Yeah, because I follow a lot of the blogs that I would normally read through just like an HTML browser, mm-hmm. like Green Car Congress, The Oil Drum, etc. I follow those on Facebook, and I know that if I go to their page on Facebook, I can see all their normal blog posts, but those posts don't appear in my feed. That
exactly.
explains why.
Yeah.
So the they're
idea
just
is
not paying Facebook.
Pay us if you really want to reach gotcha. Your fans. Which is, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, that's a topic on itself, quite frankly. I mean, yeah, hey, people's got to get paid, right?
Right.
First of all, we
could it's a different ad revenue model than I guess what Google has taken with the explicit, you know, pay for space.
We gotta give Google, you know, I mean, their motto. I mean, let's say they're less evil than most, shall we say, at the very least.
Frankly. Oh yeah, I've got a lot of respect. Less evil than
most. But that's how they all start, though.
Well, you know what's interesting? I mean, you know, Google's been around for a while. What's interesting about them is that, you know, they basically they hire the smartest people they can find, mm-hmm. and they give them a reasonable budget, and they say, okay, well, go do whatever.
Give them freedom to do what
they
think
is cool. Go do what you think is a good idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's panned out for Google very well. There's an incubator within Google called Google X, right? And, you know, they were, I'm trying to remember what was Google X's first thing. I don't even remember what it was. It was just last year. But now this year, Google X's thing is Google Glass, right?
Yeah, that's the fan, that's coming up. That's a whole element in itself.
Right, and then, you know, then they have a Google X that should, I think Google I.O. is in June, so in about a month or so, we'll find out with the next Google.
I got to say that my big, I mean, the minute I can afford that thing, I'm getting it, but I'm too broke to be an early adopter, so I will diligently wait for version 2, but I have a fashion issue with it. Anybody who knows me knows I'm a really very fashionable guy.
Yeah, sure.
My kids say I look like a bum. You know, that's kind of the look I'm going for. The way the economy is going and things are going around, you know, I think I might actually, like with my fellow middle-class Americans, we will be bums very soon indeed, if we don't do something about it. But I mean, as a kind of cyberpunk, 80s cyberpunk fan, I mean, sci-fi is my favorite form of art, you know? Other than rock and roll and Smashing Pumpkins were brilliant last night. I have to say that. I'm still in the afterglow, right? But why not big wraparound mirror shades, you know?
Oh, like something out of Star Trek?
Resolution.
What was that one character out of Star Trek that
but
had?
That was
Geordi?
Yeah,
Geordi,
yeah.
No, it's the 80s cyberpunk, I mean, you know, with William Gibson and Bruce Sterling and others. There was kind of, you know, the idea already of, you know, having all that information in your glasses. So they look a little bit too much something that would fit on some kind of, you know, disco dolly's face. I would go for something a little more
a roller scaler
in terms of look, you know. So I'm not quite happy with the slick, you know, up-to-date look. I would like to get the retro model if possible. But anyway, we'll worry about that later. But this is a violation of a violation, you know. This is a departure from a Web 2.0 model, right?
Right.
Famously, it's YouTube was kind of the paradigm for this, right? Where you just provide a platform, Facebook, of course. You provide a platform, and why do you go on these things? Because of the content. But who bought the content? Not today, too, but not companies. Users like you, right? That is what Web 2.0 means. That you go online to this site, like Facebook, like YouTube, not because they signed contract with movie studios or whatever, and they have channels, you know? No. Like it was Web 1.0, you know? You have your website, and it's your content, which you provide on your website. No, here it's just a platform. And the only reason that it's worth anything is because users are sharing their stuff or their pirated stuff on it. Now here, so, you know, Mr. Zuckerberg, you know, your many, many millions of dollars are based on the content of people who are sharing it for free. Now, all right, you know, brilliant platform. I wish it would not be so badly coded and horribly constructed.
Yeah.
And I wish I wouldn't get all that stupid, like, fantasy soft porn stuff on the side of my page all the time, which I find somewhat annoying. I'm not a Puritan, but I just find it annoying when it shoves stuff in my
face. Yeah, you get weird stuff. I get weird stuff.
You mean like Bang Your Friends?
And the mobile. that's a weird concept in itself, you know? Maybe that's where we need to
I get weird ads. I get ads for, like, these extreme races. Like, you know, run through mud for 5 miles, Tampa.
Run through mud for 5 miles.
Yeah, I mean, it's... I'm not real sure how they pull it off my profile page.
You wonder exactly. I mean, I know sometimes I get weird
stuff from
my old life.
It's an algorithm. It's probably...
But a bad algorithm. But again, and don't even start us on the mobile application. I mean, as you may know, the reason why the Facebook IPO was such a mess, the initial public offering, and anyway, why the markets
can't get mobile to work.
From the start, I mean, they so missed the point. To think that Facebook would be something that will be overwhelmingly done sitting at a desktop computer...
Right.
And not realizing that at the time, it wasn't that long ago. I think when I joined real early, that was when it was still only for colleges.
I think 2005, 2006,
something like that.
Like shortly after...
You had to have a .edu email address in order to join. I remember that.
But again, it's pretty hokey, and it's so big that you can't leave it, though. You know, I kind of abandon. though I would think that I realize as I explore the world of New World, to me in some sense, certainly as a producer of blogging, the blogosphere, all that stuff.
The blogosphere.
You know, seeing people, I've been reading articles of theirs, you know, for years, and now seeing how they do it, you know, where they start, and learning from them. I mean, the real stuff is off of Facebook. Facebook is a very limited tool, and it is, to some extent, maybe good for, you know, keeping up with granny.
Right.
Yeah, it's sort of a mob-type mentality, I mean, the whole concept of it, because everybody posts whatever they want, whether it's going to the bathroom or, you know, eating a sandwich, something like that. And yeah, I mean, that's why...
You've got, like, your, what is it, the 9 types of Facebook people. Oh. Right.
Look at what I made for dinner. But hey, I respect,
I get some of those.
Whatever makes you happy, I don't have a problem. It's easy to ignore.
Right. I mean, that's why I dropped off in 2008, and subsequently every year I drop off of Facebook. Just get tired of, you know, the comments that people make.
Politically motivated, like, you know, political extremes, and, you know, they'll make a statement that they don't want to have a reasonable discussion about
it.
But it's fun. That was a good one on Chris's...
Chris, you know what? Chris, I was actually going to say, that would be a good topic. Unfortunately, Chris can't join us today, but I mean,
apparently is good, so...
That was a great conversation. And we finally got somebody rightward leaning to say, you know, you Keynesian spend is wrong. There's going to be moral retribution for all this government spending. The U.S. dollar is going
to
collapse.
Yeah, we need to bring that person on the show.
I'd love to just have a discussion. I mean, just, you know, where's the evidence?
No, it had to be partisanized, which I stepped in. That's all I had. You guys are having a perfect discussion. No need for me to chime in except for just to remind the Democrats in the discussion that what are you talking about? Austerity. Who's doing the austerity twice as hard? Alice Through the Looking Glass, The Walrus and the Carpenter, one of my favorite poems. This whole thing. I mean, there's a lot of interpretation. Usually it's about sex, in a sense, that so, you know, the walrus and the carpenter walking, and they trick a bunch of oysters to come on a walk with them, but actually then they eat them. So if you watch, you know, my wife's Secret of the Fairy shows, you're probably already, like, ready to interpret that. you know, these are young virgins, and they are like the fairy tale tradition that often, you know, gives advice to young women in old times.
In the wrong direction.
I read it always rather more generically political, maybe a little bit less sophisticated, but, you know, we have the right to interpret whatever we want any way we want it, certainly in the arts. I always thought of it as, at the end, when she's interpreting and arguing with Humpty Dumpty about it, the idea is that yes, who do you prefer? And the thing is that the carpenter is kind of pretty hard-nosed about it. But the walrus is constantly crying, feeling bad for the poor oysters. But then it's pointed out to Alice that, yeah, maybe you think that the walrus, at least he felt bad about it, but underneath his handkerchief, where he was crying all the time, he ate twice as many. So that is really what, that's a life-changing poem for me. That was like early on, I went like, you know? And so to Democrats, I say, who are the austerity bandits around here? Do we know that austerity is pretty much a sham? There was the paper recently exposed. Colbert did a wonderful job on that, by the way.
That was
really
solid.
Nice job.
That was solid. For our listeners, it's the paper that was recently exposed was written by Professors Reinhardt and Rogoff, which I believe they're at Yale and Harvard, respectively.
No, at Harvard. Rogoff is Harvard, and Reinhardt is a very Maryland, one of those Ivy League state schools, I believe. Okay. I do think, but I might be confused.
But I mean, it's basically
respectable, right. The serious economists out there.
They had a paper that where they did a regression analysis of countries comparing their GDP to their debt loads. And the findings of the paper were that once countries cross this
90%
of debt to GDP, that for every percentage of the debt increased, GDP fell by a tenth of a percentage point. Or I'm within the ballpark of what
the conclusions
were.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically numerical, mathematical argument.
It was the intellectual justification.
If we let debt go up as we are, oh my God, our economy is going to collapse.
And what was interesting is that, the Reiner and Rogoff paper was published in the American Economic Review, which is a peer-reviewed journal, very well-respected. It's been around for, 80 years at least. I mean, it's a very old journal. But they published the paper for a review session, which, is basically like a seminar of, for people that publish in the journal. And as a result, it wasn't subject to peer review. It was an interesting loophole. So the paper was never peer reviewed until recently when some professors at University of Maryland, they finally harassed Reiner and Rogoff into giving up their data, which they did. And it turns out that there was significant error in the way the Excel sheet was, the way the correlation was computed, right?
No, wait. It's like a fine story. I mean, how it develops. I want to say that there are many Ivy League economists who are frauds.
Right.
Like, they have double. I mean, I mentioned it before. I love, one of the reasons why I love and keep showing the documentary, the great American documentary from 2009, Inside Job, which I think is the best one piece of media you can if you want to learn about the crisis, and it has the advantage of being truly nonpartisan. So it exposes, the last chapter of that documentary is about the economists. We forget, these respectable economists who lie for money. I'm sorry, Now, it's not like somebody shows up like in Politicians with a suitcase full of money, but it's legal in America, so what do you want? In most countries, it's not legal to show up with a suitcase full of money to a politician and tell him what to do, right? Then think about it. It's insane,
yeah, sure.
Right? I mean, they do it everywhere, don't get me wrong, but this is the only place where it's outright legal. I mean, how rotten is that? I mean, come on, at least people... No, anyway. These two economists are not crooks. So I want to say that. However, they are, definitely part of the status quo, of the neoclassical mainstream, etc. There are significant economists that literally get paid, sit on boards, sit on the president's advisory committee, and nobody tells them, oh, lie to the public about macroeconomics. No, but if you talk the talk,
right, it's implied.
The offers to be sitting on boards show up. But if you stop talking the talk, then change your mind because you've realized that you made a mistake. But that's very rare, and that's the point to say, Jeffrey Sachs, who was very instrumental in terrible imperialistic policies, believing that that's how poor countries, will rise through opening their markets and global free trade and blah, blah, blah. And eventually he realized he was wrong. Really amazing, because it's not often that you find an economist. I think Paul Samuelson famously said that economics progresses one funeral at a time.
Right. That's
one funeral at a time.
It's wonderful. So these guys are not rotten. Now, I've got to make a plug here, as I did already on the blog. So a one of the few major research institutions, so make PhDs too, not like us, in America, one of the handful that are not dominated by a very particular view that came to power after World War II barely, so, you know, pretty radical, it's neoclassical, what we'd consider to be the mainstream today. The stuff you get in that big, horrible book some of you were subjected to called Economics, that stuff. It used to be considered...
By Samuelson, probably.
Yeah, oh, yeah, Samuelson has been ever since, you know. It's
I still have my copy, yeah. You know.
But well, he wrote a book, a 1946 book. It was kind of a technical book. He didn't expect it to become a you know, some kind of like Mao, you know, back in the old China, you know, Mao's Little Red Book.
Little Red Book, right, yeah.
So-called free marketeers who wouldn't know it if they hit free markets hit them in the face, you know, shake it around everywhere. But then what happens is that one of these great departments, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, because it's a very big school, University of Massachusetts has several campuses. It's a diverse, one of the few diverse programs. So you have different ideologies, including a couple of Marxists, because, you know, yeah, because Marx, I mean...
It's in the spectrum.
All the Austrians spent, you know, all the right wing was spent, the great founders of the right wing, von Mises, yeah. Hayek, all that. I mean, I like them or not, they spend their entire lives carefully working through Marx and responding,
right.
Accepting yeah. most of what he had to say, but making very significant changes, you know? So the idea of, oh, Marx, I mean, that doesn't even fit anything but ignorance, you know? Because the serious fathers of right-wing economic thought took him very, very seriously and learned from him a lot. University of Utah, I'd like to plug. I tried to get a job there, but hard, very competitive. Back in the day, before I came here, actually. That failed. But I go there for conferences sometimes, and you know, and I'm, we brought on my YouTube channel, we got Rick Wolf, who reminded me to get back about why Google is actually so successful, because he's big on democracy in the workplace. I've posted right. about it, but that's something we really need to spend time on. But so they as part of their training, there's no cheerleading in Amherst, right? It's a serious academic program. So the students have to pick papers and reproduce their results, right? And verify them and learn the real how to do science. And this kid's working, he can't reproduce the results because they're unreproducible. But that's right. why scientists reproduce results, you know?
That's
hello, all
right.
you economists who think that methodology and philosophy of science is not important. It's not important if you don't care about getting to the truth. Otherwise, it is. So they're trying, and he has the support of the faculty, which are not all Marxists, by the way. It's a minority, small minority of Marxists, but they are committed to pluralism. People need to learn all the different kinds of schools, and even if they don't like something, they need to learn it and know what they're talking about. Call me old-fashioned. Anyway, eventually they ask these guys for the data, and they give it to them. So again, you know, they're not. There's a whole world of not sharing data going on, by the way, which is fraud and multiple levels problematic, you know. Another aspect.
There's no justification for it within economics either. It's not like it's
money.
Well,
data sets, you can get a lot of money off of data sets. Way beyond, you know, there's even monopoly rents going on. It's not like, yeah, you got to pay people collecting data, constructing data. They need to get paid. But there's, yeah, I mean, there's no excuse. Yeah, it's about
monopoly. I mean, well, it's not like you're a pharmaceutical researcher and you're patenting a new drug and you need to, you know, keep it
turf,
quiet. Yeah.
It's still turf. Turf is turf, right? Turf
right.
Boys, right? You think scientists are some noble creatures that are above the fray of scrambling over resources? Hell no. So there you are, that student kind of exposed. They were kind of open about it. They behaved, you know, all right about it. But all this long story that I think we've told again, but I think it's bear repeating, is to, we actually here at Rollins, in the economics department, in the arts and sciences, we actively find that in order to support, to have people qualified to teach in our, again, kind of, we do a baby version, a very diverse, all schools of thought are explained and evaluated critically. You know, when our senior seminars have to, and I shout out for you guys, they're really in a bad place now, probably putting the last tweaks on their draft, and I really hurt, you know, you got to address whatever issue you're addressing from multiple ideological perspectives. Otherwise, you're a pundit, not interested. as an academic, if you just telling me one side of the story, I'm not listening already. You know, you're boring me. You're obviously, you're not doing your work here. Tell me, you know, if they say, oh, but here, they say that. And I immediately say, well, find me somebody who disagrees and analyze it critically. And then, of course, at the end, you say, I agree with this position. Fine, no problem. But it's not because I just picked this position because I like it. No, no, no. Sadly, so much social sciences is done like that. But not in this department. And we work really hard on this, and the students love it, you know, and whatever their ideology is, which, by the way, overwhelmingly is very right-wing, you know, but they want to learn their Marxism. They find, yeah, yeah, I need to know this stuff. If nothing else, even if you want to fight it better.
Right, right, right.
I mean, you know what you don't like, otherwise...
Know your enemy.
You're ignorant, and the position of ignorance is a position of weakness. But... we hire from Amherst. In fact, maybe overhire, because it's difficult for us to find such qualified people who have knowledge of multiple schools of thought, who can teach this stuff and not orchestrate cheerleading sessions, as most economic departments do. Hence, we have three of them. So everybody's all over the press in America now. Oh, Amherst, I mean, not in America, all over the world, The Guardian. Oh, this amazing department in America, University of Amherst, you know, Massachusetts at Amherst. Wow, wow, wow. And I'm like, we got three of them. You know? we really like, seek to hire them because they're just, they can step into our classes. They can hit the topic from multiple perspectives. They can do that stuff. And most economists can't. Like my guru, extreme right winger, Austrian, I mean, not Deirdre McCloskey, said, you know, they're idiot savants. You know, that's what we create in the graduate program. They can do one thing amazingly well, but they have no idea what's going on.
And for everybody who's listening out there, you can call us here at 407-646-2915 with any questions you may have or just comments.
You know, and we didn't really get to the end of it, but a conclusion of that paper, I mean, this is just kind of, we've been working on an assumed conversation, we both know it, but for our listeners, what those researchers at Amherst found is that the paper had some serious methodological flaws. You know, they purposely, Reinhard Rogoff purposely excluded certain data sets. They basically...
You can't, I mean, that's, of course, that's a allegation in a sense. We can't, it could be either... shockingly sloppy, though.
I don't know. I don't think it's enough. I mean, okay, you're trying to be nice to them. I give you credit for that. But, I mean, the fact
it's
is...
the last night concert. I'm in such a good mood.
They excluded data from Australia.
Yeah.
You know what?
Excluded all the anomalies, all the stuff that didn't fit. But you know, welcome to my world.
Hold on, wait. They basically all they did was exclude countries where they had high debt loads and high GDP growth.
No.
And they purposely excluded a portion of the U.S. time series. I believe it was like from 1945 to 1957. They purposely excluded that period of U.S. history from the data series. And then they had some very interesting ways of weighting the data series. Like, you know, they weighted, you know, the experience of, like, the Philippines the same as, like, you know, say, a much larger economy such as the U.S.
Yeah. I'll say again, welcome to my world. It's kind of shocking.
Well, what's been shocking to me is really how... You know, and this was Chris's point on the Facebook, you know, sorry, Chris, if you're listening, if I'm stealing the thunder from Friday's show, but, you know, the right in economics has basically, they've just kind of plugged their ears, and it's like, well, if we don't respond, maybe this isn't real.
It's fake, huh?
I mean, you know, the ideological underpinnings for, you know, austerity around the world has just basically been completely shattered.
Economics has become some form of religion, you know?
I think it has been for a long time.
Yeah. But I think, let's think about it. There are a couple of things going on. I mean, first of all, that faith-based, you know, where when you get instances that don't fit your model, traditionally, you're supposed to go back to the model. If the world doesn't fit your model, ooh, look, Galileo famously looked up with a telescope he didn't invent... on Jupiter, and saw that there's absolutely no way the moons of Jupiter that he could see with his eyes are fit the at the time Ptolemaic view of the universe of these beautiful crystal spheres nested within each other. Anybody seen in museums sometimes these kind of sphere and sphere and sphere kind of globes. That's it. Okay. Beautiful, beautiful. Harkens back to a view of the world from Aristotle, 500 BC, and that was the way it is. And the reason why the church at the time, we're talking 1500s here, right? Didn't, right? Yeah.
You got it.
Well, the end? Yeah, the end of 15, early 100s, beginning of 1600s. Didn't like it. Actually, they knew. There were mathematicians, like today, brilliant scientists sitting in the Vatican, you know, and they knew it was right. There was no, clearly about it. And Copernicus had been already, you know,
right,
sanctioned for that a long time ago. So it wasn't news. It was a political problem. That if the people in this era, an era of the most worst era in European history, people kind of Renaissance. Dark Ages was no picnic, you know, no doubt. But in many ways, you know, people think of the Renaissance as, oh, finally we're getting out of the Middle Ages. No, that was a period of war, pestilence, half the population, the horrible period. While the Middle Ages, in many cases, was a period of relatively high standard of living.
Stability.
But yeah, definitely. That's another story. But the problem was that these people suffering in this upheaval and religious reformation, you know, before Luther there was rumblings for a long time, right? They just got to burn them all in time. Well, Luther they didn't get, you know? So
German people
wasn't
kind of have an obsession with that, by the way, over history.
Well, yeah, I know.
I mean, you know, they made the Salem witch trials look like a picnic.
Oh, yeah. I mean, in the Renaissance, they're so corrupt, too. I mean, it wasn't when people were, the Inquisition of the Middle Ages was about doctrine and heresy. In the Renaissance, it was about money. You know, you just denounce your neighbor and take over their property. That was not what it's about. So it was became, and like often is the case, when the economic incentives are in place, the bloodbath begins. That's the case for slavery, and almost any horrible, or for all the people, the New World slavery. Let's remember again the hundreds of Bangladeshi women and children, you know, buried under rubble for corporate profits in the garment industry. And they arrested the manager over there, but I don't see them arresting the CEOs of Walmart,
of
Target,
right,
whatever, all the brands, whatever they are. Right,
right. Those end up donating to some charity and being forgiven.
Yeah, but the problem is that they couldn't hit the people with the notion that humanity is not at the center of the universe. Because if you're living so horribly, at least you are the jewel of creation. You know, at least you're at the center of attention of God. And they weren't ready to shift that around and start explaining that it's okay, we can still be, you know, under our God, even though we are the third planet from the sun, it's all good. But the notion, Galileo started modernity, science, everything, by uttering the argument, I don't care what you believe, look, eh? That's huge. That's what Galileo's all about. Yeah, clever guy, no doubt, but that's why Galileo changed the world, with that notion. And so back to this type of papers, and that's just one example. In fact, so much of economics,
economics is
based
is
on
riffed,
stuff like that. You know, it's all of those things. Minimum wage, for example. The notion, if you raise minimum wage, you're going to increase unemployment for unskilled workers. No. The data, you raise minimum wage, you get more employment. Why are we against minimum wage? So that we can pay people less.
Right.
You know, so we can get more profits and less wages for people. And not only does it hurt those people, it slows down the entire economy. So it's really unconscientious. Now, is it based on faith? Do they believe that stuff? I ask my students often, you know, read a lot of rich people, surely, you know, when they call themselves job creators and they're looking in the mirror in the morning when they shave, I mean, you know you've been outsourcing for the past 10 years. You know you haven't created a single job. Yet you sit around and call yourself job creator. So are you in denial? Are you a complete cynic? Because if anybody knows, you know, they should, because they know they don't create. Or do you somehow believe it in a kind of a faith? I think there's a lot of that people can believe anything to make themselves, you know, to solve the conflict in their head, because maybe they're fundamentally decent. Yet they are living in an indecent role, and they have to psych. I'm not a psych. You know, you're the psych major. Hey, congrats! He's like, you're done, huh?
You know, it's funny. Relevant thing. There's an article on NPR this morning. I actually have it on my phone right here, and it's entitled "Elegance Trumps Ethics in a Scientific Scandal." It's a very good read, and it references a New York piece, and it talks about a Dutch social psychologist by the name of Diedrich Stapel, who you know, most people
don't know.
I actually kind of hope most people have never heard of him, but he basically committed fraud. He fabricated his data for like 20 odd years.
Oh,
right, just totally fabricated it.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was, you know, questioned, I don't want to read the article verbatim now, but it's something along the lines of when he was questioned by some of his peers, well, why did you do it?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, simply put, some of these explanations for, you know, for psychological phenomena were so elegant, and the data were just conflicting with it. Basically, it's just like, the data just posed too many questions for an elegant solution. And anyways, this article goes on to talk about how there is actually, humans have a predisposition for very simple and elegant explanations.
Right.
And you know, this kind of goes, you know, going to economics, you know, the whole linear, you know, straight line hockey stick supply demand model. I mean,
it's a simple matter of demand and supply. And
right,
Marshall's spinning in his grave.
Right,
he invented them.
I mean, that's something simple. I mean, it fits on a poster, if you will.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and it's easy for people to process. I mean, people in their everyday lives, they have a lot of information to process. So, you know, the simple things tend to stick, and unfortunately, the simple things tend to be wrong. I mean, you know, minimum wage. Which I think we had a show. It's complicated, right?
Because
clarify to your point, you can increase minimum wage and increase, but at some point there is a drop off in employment.
Well, it has a negative effect on according to the supply and demand. That's true.
Right.
It's just that it. Given the context and the complexity of your world,
it's non-linear.
It has more offsetting positive effects.
It's non-linear, right? And I mean, really, in order to understand non-linear relationships, I mean, you know, there have been studies. It's something like only 4% of the population actually they need to use like advanced algebra in their day-to-day work.
Well, yeah,
right.
Maybe we should, you know. Sometimes, you know, you think maybe, you know, we need to complicate our lives a little so we won't be fooled. That life is like a soap opera. But we do live in the saturated media propaganda world, and the kids are being brainwashed from preschool. And it's not an ideological brainwash. You know, I know maybe a lot of my right-wing friends will say, what do you mean? You know, in school, they're all like giving them a lot of left-wing kind of, or liberal, because I don't think liberal qualify for left-wing. They don't deserve it. you know, be true blue or true red. You know what I mean?
But you know, that article does...
Control mechanisms, not ideological. Like, break them down so they respect authority. That's kind
that,
of...
That article does bring a point, because when you look at propaganda, if you may, the most... effective messages are the ones that are very short and simple.
Right.
And, I mean, I don't want to say that people are just, I don't know, downright ignorant or whatever, but it seems like it's easier to digest something that's very catchy. Yeah. So you have slogans, you have the catchphrase of the day, and a lot of times most of these messages are the complete opposite.
And we all like that, by the way. You know, we all like that. I mean, it's one of these things that's important, actually. We have to understand that we are all susceptible. It works on everybody.
Yeah,
it's not like I'm sitting here saying, no, this stuff doesn't work on me. No, it works on me. I'm just constantly struggling to realize how it's playing in my brain and trying to spit it out, you know, like poison. And I try, you know, but that's all you can do. It's not doesn't work on me.
It's economization of information. I mean, it's a survival mechanism. You know, it's been evolved into our psychologies, and for good reason. It's just that, you know, our world has reached this disconnect, this nonlinear disconnect, where, you know, things aren't simple one-to-one relationships anymore, and that's why the simple can get us into trouble now.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And it's a problem also for running a democratic market system.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why James Burke in the 70s, great historian of science and philosopher of science, he predicted back in the early 70s already, we got a problem. The world is so complex, and people cannot understand, I mean, without dedicating their lives to studying it. And of course, if they did that, we don't starve, you know? So thank you for not dedicating your life to studying it, you know? But both in the sense, think of how we don't understand the equipment on which we depend. I mean, can you repair your air conditioning if it breaks down, you know? Or will
sometimes
you, like me, have
kick.
To hang yourself, you know, when the humidity goes up? Some of us, yeah, you know, but we, and then we, then there are other things that maybe you can't repair. At the same thing, we, do we understand the complexity of the political economy surrounding us? No, it's very difficult to understand. Sometimes, you know, the poor peasant in Colombia, you know, getting gunned down by the government forces, you know, because he's an indigenous and he wants his rights, probably understands the global economy better than most of us in the rich world because, you know, he feels it, you know, in a bad way. But not understanding, how can you have democracy? People are, cannot, you know, will then have to trust specialists. And then, of course, as we, you know, then the powerful will buy their own specialists. And that's why our media lies to us and even academics. It's one of the last frontiers now is the education system and the academic system. I mean, those of us, the lobbyists are taking that over now as we speak.
One of the last vestiges of pure thought and... Not anymore.
Not pure, but at least, you know, there was sufficient mess. It's always, to some extent, the power, you know, the status quo, the powerful kind of more dominate than other times. But what made the American and other places, too, when that was the case, the academic system so great and coming with this, all this creativity and all, you know, look at America. I mean, America dominated the 20th century, not with... you know, stupid TV shows like now, you know, it dominated in science and arts and literature. Right. People forget that, you know. It's not, we were just making money, but the art, everything was here.
It was an incredible societal rise. I mean,
the second half of the 20th century, certainly, you know, but that's because you gotta have that freedom. You gotta let that cuckoo out there that you think is entirely out of his mind. Let him do his thing, because you never know, and you might learn something. And that's, even by arguing against him, it'll improve your own argument. You know?
That's largely Taleb's point, and it's one of the things Taleb warns about, is that, you know, what really made the United States so great was the fact that there was a tremendous amount of economic experimentation. Mm. You know, it was very entrepreneurial. Mm.
I mean, lots of it didn't work, so yeah, a lot of it got nasty, and you know, fine, that's normal. But yeah, just the pluralism. This is actually the core argument of diversity, the scientific argument for diversity. You must have diversity because the environment keeps changing. I'm not talking about weather, climate change right now. I'm just talking about, well, everything surrounding us, right? It changes, right? If you're perfectly specialized for a specific environment, you're doomed to extinction.
Right.
Like T-Rex, you know?
Yep, especially.
Is the best example. Dominating. Nothing like it. The jewel of creation. The best organism ever created. Except for when the environment changed due to a comet strike, probably.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, it's the little, disgusting little rats that have the advantage.
Or it ran out
That's
of food.
Yeah. So you're perfectly suited, but... that's a problem. The real rule of economics, of evolutionary theory, of common sense is be ready, be flexible, be adaptable, because your world is going to change, and it is changing dramatically today. I mean, in this era, not today specifically, but we are living an era which is probably at least as important as the Industrial Revolution, and much more rapid in many ways, maybe even as the Renaissance.
Yeah, I wonder if in the future are people going to look back and decide that the whole system was based on Facebook or not. I mean, just seeing how everybody's so attached, even the government politicians advertise on Facebook.
Sure,
I mean, this for the last decade, that's what it's been all about.
I feel like, you know, the world in general has kind of they've bought into social media wholesale. And in a way, I almost kind of wonder if people don't do that because it's like, you know, well, maybe we're running out of employment opportunities or
friends. We have no friends. We're lonely.
Right.
Like Gary Newman. We need to next you can't call it. Yes, what is it? We are not human, we are not romantics, we're here to serve you. I mean, he's got a song, Our Friends Electric, ? 1979. Electronic music in 1979. Gotta give him credit there.
You know, this is kind of going back to the whole, you know, thing, do people really believe it or not? And this kind of ties in with what you were just saying about Facebook. You know, I was just at an energy conference up in New York. It's kind of a closed circle thing. I'm not going to mention where it was. But, you know, you had a lot of major utility players there. And they talked about projects that they're working on. And they talked about how, you know, the local council, they like to see job creation, right? That's mm-hmm. what they like to see. And you could tell by the way they were saying it. It was almost like, you know, we can actually do this at a much lower cost. We don't need nearly as many people. But something in the back of their minds is kind of like, well, you know, we probably should produce, like, some jobs. And I mean, these
right,
aren't
right, right, right.
You know, one thing, utilities, I mean, it's become, there are two sides of utilities. There's the distribution, which is a natural monopoly, and, you know, that's where the fat cats are. And then there's the generation, which is actually a very cutthroat industry, right, where, I mean, it's, you know, margins are very thin. I mean, it's a true market, you know, in a traditional sense. And you could see that, you know, these participants, they were actually kind of worried, because it was almost like their worldview. They believed in this, you know, more economic growth will, you know, and will it'll create jobs, but it's not actually materializing for them. And I mean, I'm starting to see that in more and more places. It's a kind of like this conflict. So I think what it is, you know, people, they do believe in the traditional views, and it's just
it's typical of an era of change. Again, as a
right.
historian, it's like the 16th, 17th century. People were, this new world was confusing and didn't fit their, you know. We all feel it, right? That malaise, you use the French word typically, right? This kind of discomfort that we have of something's wrong here. We don't know exactly what, but we're unhappy with this, and this is not working out, and unfamiliar. So there's definitely this kind of a tension. The thing is, what are we going to do about it? Mechanisms of control make us just take our pills and watch TV and hope that things will get better. But typically history teaches us they don't. You got to do something about it, or they don't necessarily get better at all. They usually actually get worse. And there's this pluralism is important, I think, precisely, and it's scientific, if you will, you know, that you do have to have multiple models, because we don't know what's going to succeed. So we have to have a very broad, actually. It's one of the main arguments that all the big thinkers in education, for example, are screaming blue murder, that the general zeitgeist, you know, sign of the times, the general policy from Washington all the way down is for specialization, giving job skills, practical education, and the real experts are unanimous screaming blue murder about that's wrong. That's just bad methodology again, yeah? Because we don't know what the job skills are going to be in 5 years from now. So what we need is to have... There's a call for liberal arts, what we attempt to do here, you know? Roy Rollins, we don't give you specific skills, practical skills, to get them, you know, that the job, frankly, you know, even corporate America says that what they want is the ability to write well, to communicate orally, speak well, present, pick up a topic, learn it, master it.
Right.
You know,
it's
very generic. Just how to learn, we're supposed to teach. How to critically learn, not to teach specific stuff.
One of the venture capital blogs that I follow, Gigeo, they recently actually had an article that was interesting. It was kind of along the same lines. What they were talking about were the skill sets necessary for the jobs of the future. Mm. And it was actually an extremely short and concise article where they had a lot of, you know, recently successful entrepreneurs. Zuckerberg was one of them.
Mm.
And what they were saying is that...
Did he list stab your friends in the back? Hey, some very successful, important people were real.
Gates, yeah. But, no, basically what the conclusion was is the most important skill set you can have is to be able to rapidly learn a new skill set.
Of course, yeah.
That makes sense.
It makes sense. And what they're saying is learn how to learn.
Exactly. I mean, John Dewey said it here at Rollins, actually, in the 1930s, you know. When he started this whole liberal arts, we were actually players in the liberal arts, American liberal arts education tradition. But it's been eroded down to a tiny minority, often, you know, with very high barriers to entry. We have scholarships here, but, you know, let's not play with us all, you know. Holt is in a way...
What do you think is going to happen to liberal arts as we know it? Is it going to go away? Or?
The overwhelming, power is very doubtful of its benefits. In fact, you know, but sadly, look at again Obama. I hate to always rip into him. It's not like it's just that
Yeah, it's the truth. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, you know, is this education initiatives? I mean, this is just terrible. I mean, he's getting I don't know. I guess for profit education lobbyists telling him, persuading him, and there's a lot of shoddy work, and all this. You know, and don't start me on the public education system. It is sick to the core. You know, it's a sick system, and this is not an attack on teachers. You know, it's the system, and
right,
you know,
they're right.
Sick. Teachers, men, some of them are, you know, horrible, but many of them are doing their best and are excellent, you know. But you can't be good in a sick system, or it's very difficult, and in fact quite grinding down, because you're like, you know, unlike Google, you know. Once again,
that's
the democracy in the workplace. I mean, before we even run out of time, I'd like to throw that facetious thing I like to throw. I mean, you want modern 21st century homegrown American communism? Google. You know, Marx would have approved. Yeah, yeah, not the Marxist, many of which don't even read Marx themselves, much like the right-wingers who just read Mises, Hayek, etc. But that's where most bona fide people who call themselves socialists today are looking at, you know, and therefore I keep plugging and we need to organize this whole like sharing of links and stuff. We will promise, you know. After the 14th,
I got a link.
I have a
the last show, I got a link.
Got a link.
I've got a pending blog post.
We'll make it somehow a little bit more organized, but I will have a life again after the 14th, and that's one of the major things I'm going to work on over the summer. But you know, I like to say, I mean, I shouldn't say, most people won't call it communism, right? Because it's, you know, the C word, right?
Right.
But whatever, you know, what does it mean? You know, the word communism comes from old times, you know, a historical concept. The Soviets, I keep saying, right, had very little to do with it, if you ask me, you know. But they were just a dictatorial, nasty, brutal elite, you know, that used that excuse, you know, like they use the Quran in Iran, you know.
Right. But it's no different than today. I mean, The difference between them and today is basically we know how to do it with better style and with more candy coating, you know, just to make sure everybody else can digest it.
But the real point is, like, you know, Google is so successful and is not immediately turning evil, you know,
right.
Because it runs on a political economic system of freedom. Its workers are empowered. They're their own bosses to a large extent. Nobody tells them what to do. When they have an initiative, they're given the resources to do it. Now, if they fail again, they get fired. You know?
Yeah? And rightly so, yeah, sure.
Right, you know, but there's no blaming then. Oh, he told me to do it. Oh, it's not my fault. No, it's your baby. You had we gave you full power. You tried. And they do accept some failure, which is very important, because if you don't accept failure, like in our education system,
right
where one mess up, your GPA is shot for life.
Right.
That is, all experts know since Benjamin Bloom in the 50s, that is how you destroy education. You got high risk exam, people don't learn, you know. So I just talked with my students last session, you know, and some of the better, the overachievers, the 4.0, they know it too. They just figured out the system and played it. Did they flourish?
I'll raise my hand on that one.
Creative? Did you go for it? Did you came on your own time?
Sure.
I remember my son Felix, you know, handing me, like, when he was in the schooling system, he's handing me, like, oh, this is what I would do about this assignment. Like, it was 6 or something. But this is what I'm handing in, so I get an A.
Yeah.
So you had to dumb it down. And that's what he handed in. So, you know, and he's the kind of kid that would do well in a similar system, you know, academic. They know how to, you know, you learn. It's like a video game, people. You know, you figure out what's going on and slay the beast, you know.
You know, for some...
the boss, right?
It's totally 100%. It's 100%, yeah.
From somebody who's graduating this week, I got to say, there's been many times where I've done a certain amount of work in psych, and then I've turned around and gone like, yeah, let me go ahead and turn to something else. Not that the previous work was, you know, bad or anything like that, but just to basically accommodate the professors. And
there's
also been many times, too, where some of my professors, their data has been past dated or incorrect. And after a while, I've learned just to keep my mouth shut and just stay seated. Because, you know, some people do interpret that as, stepping on my turf, where's your paperwork or whatever. But in reality, it seems to me that in our education system, you should challenge the student to just come up and with knowledge that it's going to not impress the professor, because you really can't impress professors, but pretty much to bring something to the table.
Surprised.
you know, something new, something innovative that's going to give, you know, promote some
But you need the freedom,
thought.
Right? I mean,
right,
that's
right.
Play.
No, that's
Dude,
just it.
It's the root of my attention to video games and such, and generally play in the classroom, is because that's how animals learn. I mean, it's like, it's basic, it's ABC. If our system is based on breaking down people in the age of industrial change, you know, in the 19th century, where there was a lot of, like, revolutions brewing, and how do you break people down and make them good cogs in big industry, you know, hierarchical workers, supervisors, supervisors of supervisors, all the way up to CEO. This model that is more or less dead in terms of, you know, creating jobs and creating wealth for all but the proverbial 1%. Google is different, and they're not alone, by the way. There are other many companies like that in the United States and other rich parts of the world that are doing it differently. And most importantly, they're empowering their workers. And the best school systems allows, just like animals, you know, baby lions will play, you know, will play hunt with their... There's no risk. That's the whole point.
Right, right.
So they can learn how to pounce safely. If, oh no, you pounced wrong, so your GPA is down, so from now on you are going to be gamma male, you'll never get to read and eat, too bad, go away. They'd be extinct by now, and that's maybe one of the reasons why we are going extinct.
And you know, that's got to be one of the most discouraging things for a student, is that, you know, you kill their GPA, and then, because it's so hard to get it back... I find that at least 60% will choose to completely ignore it and just sit back and go like, okay, whatever.
Now I'm not even bothering anymore.
Right.
Spoil the
right.
Ring.
Yeah. Right. Which is the reason why a lot of people chose to go into work instead of just economics. I mean, academics, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not designed to teach. It's designed to break you down and have you respect authority.
Right.
So, you know you're right, but I just gave you a flogging. So you know your place.
Exactly.
That's what it's about. It's terrible. It's kind of sad. But I do think there's movements. There's a lot of movement. Just got a new book about it. So I'm trying to present it. One of the reasons why I'm so stressed out is I'm presenting an update on my research on this topic in New York. God in 10 days.
And you're right. You know, the freedom to be able to express yourself, at least communicating the terms that the class is talking about, is seriously important for any student. I mean, bottom line, if you can't express yourself, then how are you going to get your point across? And particularly, some of the professors, they give you the guidelines to follow on presentation. And let's say somebody's more on the visual side. Why can't they present?
There's another
something that's more visual.
Element, right? Multimodal education,
right.
Allow people.
Are you sure
option.
You're graduating from the Jesse?
I had to squeeze somebody by the neck. No, just kidding.
No, honesty. I mean, there's a lot of problems everywhere, including here, but I mean, we're not yet there where, you know,
No system is perfect, but. You know, we got to make it better.
People are open to criticism still, you know, and we have a lot of discussions everywhere. It's the time of flux, and education is majorly in flux too, and we should be arguing about it, hopefully as open as possibly and civilly, so that we can try different things, and some of them will work. It's very important that different things, like in environmentalism, we were talking about monoculture last time. And well, we're past time, I do believe.
Yeah, all past time.
That's okay.
I could stay here all day, but I don't think that would be fair.
Yeah, no, actually, but Punkonomics is going
to
be changing schedules pretty soon, so stay tuned to the correct time that Punkonomics is going to be on.
Still Friday, though, right?
Yeah, still Friday. But my guess is that we're going to be moving to a Monday from 4 to 5.
Yeah, I hope people listen to the radio on Monday at 4 to 5.
Yeah, well, they're usually driving, so...
Yeah.
hopefully they won't get panic attacks or want to get out of their car.
I mean, I-4 between 4 and 5 isn't so good. Listening to us might not be great.
True. Anyway,
road
folks, thank you for tuning in. This is Punkonomics here on WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. And you've been listening to Dr. Benny Balick and Corey Carroll. And my name is Jesse Velez. See you again this Friday at 9 o'clock here on the Voice of Rollins College and the Best of Basement Radio, WPRK. Have a great day.
Design. It's my own reward. Help me to decide.
reflect the views or opinions of this station, its management, or employees.
WPRK, Winter Park, Florida. I am John Lydon here of Public Image Limited. You may also know me as Rotten, and I may know you as W.